is the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. In our third hour today, Dan Sisson's going to drop by. We're going to be talking about the American Revolution of 1800 for a little bit of time, 15 to 30 minutes. We'll see how that goes. The first couple hours, you know, it's open. I did want to share a kind of geeky science thing with you that I thought was interesting. And also, I was watching this morning. This is, you know, it's the Wednesday before Thanksgiving here. Last night was the second night since the Darren Wilson decision not to indict happened. And it's a question of I'm sorry, I just got totally distracted, which is not your fault, Shane. it's mine. This morning, I was watching TV, and I was flipping back and forth between MSNBC and Fox. And I thought, you know, let me just see what's going on here. So this was at 9 o'clock Eastern time. Jose Diaz-Balart, if I'm remembering his name correctly, I've only seen the show two or three times. I don't normally watch television at this time of day. And in fact, usually I'm, well, a whole long story. But anyway, so I was flipping back between him and whoever the woman is who does the show for Fox, and I'm forgetting her name altogether, at that time. And what I thought was interesting was the news at the very beginning. Fox went to you know, their reporter on the scene in Ferguson and said, what happened last night? And he was like, I'm out in front of the city hall here, and this is where the protesters tried to burn this police car. And it was, and they were showing the, you know, on the screen, they were showing all the riot porn, as Catherine called it yesterday. And I agree. I think it's a great, great phrase. And, you know, just going through, look at this, you know, they were rocking this car last night and all. So then I flip back to MSNBC, and they go to their person on the ground, and who's one of the NBC reporters, actually. He's a little higher up the food chain than just the MSNBC network. He's actually an NBC reporter, and I can't remember his name. My apologies. I watch very little television. But in any case, he was live down in Ferguson, and he's saying, well, last night was quite peaceful, you know, and there was a lot of peaceful protesters who showed up. And he went through like 2-3 minutes of what happened in Ferguson and who said this and, you know, that and the other thing. And then he said, in kind of a summary sentence, he said, and there was, you know, a group of people who tried to flip over a police car and set it on fire last night, but they weren't successful. And they showed a little clip of that, you know, of them trying to flip the car over. And then he said, but they weren't successful. And they come back to him. So it was like on Fox, it's like, oh, my God, they're still rioting. And on MSNBC, it was like, hey, it was a calm evening. I mean, there was one exception, but it was a calm evening. We're making, you know, serious and people are having conversations about policing and about race all across the country. And literally from one coast to the other. Here in the United States. So, anyhow, we're gonna do Anything Goes Wednesday today. It's the holiday day. I know probably a lot of you are traveling, maybe listening to us on your car radio or Sirius XM. So you know, any topic you'd like to talk about, feel free to give us a shout, and we'll get into it. And Shane has been reading the transcripts. He's burrowing through these transcripts that the St. Louis County prosecutor has, district attorney has released. And it's increasingly, as I'm, you know, he's sharing bits and pieces with me, it's increasingly obvious that when a witness said Darren Wilson was right, that witness was treated with absolute kid gloves and total respect. And when a witness says Darren Wilson was wrong, that witness is treated like a hostile witness. In fact, sometimes tag-teamed, you know, good cop, bad cop, essentially cross-examined, interrogated, as opposed to simply presenting their information. And this, without asserting or trying to prejudice. Are we sure we're connected on the air? Because nobody has called in. Okay, it must just be that, you know, a lot of people are traveling. Without trying to prejudice this at all, without, you know, the truth of the matter is, I don't have any idea, and neither do you, whether Darren Wilson was justified in shooting Michael Brown or not. My opinion, my personal opinion, is that he probably was not justified, and that more often than not, these police shootings are not justified. But that's just, you know, that's reflecting my own personal bias. I realize, you know, I've got some friends who are Fox News watchers. We run into them at the little clubhouse next door to our marina. In fact, that's where we watched the press release by the DA. And, you know, people who disagree with me, people who agree with me. I mean, there's a spectrum of opinion. But I think the important point, and the point that I'm trying to make, is that we don't know. And we don't know because there wasn't a process. I want to say a confrontational process. What's adversarial? Thank you, Shane. I knew there was a legal word for that. There was no adversarial process. There was no opportunity for anybody to actually cross-examine Darren Wilson. His testimony was received uncritically. Whereas, and by and large, that was true of all the witnesses who supported what Darren Wilson said. On the other hand, the witnesses who supported what the young fellow who was with Michael Brown said, they were essentially cross-examined. They were challenged. In fact, in one of the dialogues, one of the prosecutors said, you know, I'm not trying to say you're lying, but, at the end, the witness says, no, I was there. I'm telling you what I saw. So my point isn't Darren Wilson, Michael Brown, right or wrong. It's that our system is so badly broken that we don't know, and we will never know, in all probability, in this particular case. And that should never happen again in the United States of America. We need to have a process whereby when a police officer kills somebody, or for that matter, when a police officer behaves in a way that is highly inappropriate, I mean, you know, from time to time, the vast majority of police interactions with the public and police activities are necessary, appropriate, good. I mean, you know, but when it goes bad, and police officers have been accused of robbing people, of raping people, of, you know, of just being bullies, that when those things happen, there should be a process where the police officer can be challenged that is adversarial, that is not just like this, you know, hey, let's have a friendly conversation here, by somebody who actually, you know, who works for that police officer. The prosecutors work for the police officers. And we just don't have a system like that in the United States, and I think we need one. I think we need to be giving some really serious thought to this. What do we do about this? How do we do this? So, anyhow, your thoughts on this are more than welcome. I'm scratching my head about it. I think that, you know, police review boards, community policing, the idea of having police departments represent, you know, look like the community that they're part of. I mean, there's a bunch of things here that seem like they would be good first steps. It's 15 minutes past the hour. We'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Oh, and I need to clean up and correct something I said about the drug screen for Officer Wilson yesterday. A physician let me know I was wrong. I'll tell you all about that. 15 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. And John in Merrill, Wisconsin. Hey, John, thanks for watching Free Speech TV. What's up?
Hey, Tom. Been watching your show for a while and thinking points instead of talking points. That autopsy thing for Mike Brown.
Uh-huh.
Didn't he have a bullet hole? The autopsy for Mike Brown, the report they gave out, didn't he have a bullet hole in his abdomen area?
I don't remember. I don't have the picture in front of me, and I didn't spend a lot of time examining it. I know that the head wound was the one that killed him. Why?
Yeah. The officer said that he was reaching for a gun. Why couldn't he just been doing something human, like holding his side where he was shot?
Oh yeah, that did occur to me when George Stephanopoulos was having that conversation with Darren Wilson. I did see that on TV, and or at least I saw the clips of it that MSNBC was playing. And you know, he said he put his hand down like into his waist or something. And I know in one of the conversations with the prosecutors by the witnesses, one of the prosecutors says, "Do you think he was reaching for a gun or a weapon?" And, you know, and that it occurred to me that maybe that's, you know, that would be the defense that Darren Wilson would offer. And it also occurred to me exactly what you're saying. If this guy had been shot in the stomach, you put your hand where you've been wounded.
And, yeah, I mean, people do that just for a simple sidekick. I can only imagine what a bullet would feel like. You know?
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. Well, thanks, Tom. Have
totally
a good
agree.
Thanksgiving.
Thanks a lot. You too, John. Hope you have a wonderful Thanksgiving tomorrow. Terry in Grandville, Michigan. Hey, Terry, what's on your mind today?
Hey, I was just wondering, when you take a look at what the police officers do in a situation like this, they immediately gather information from anything and everything around, except for that police officer. That police officer did not write down anything of what went down until after all evidence was collected, and it seemed like it was done so that he could make up a story that would fit into the evidence after the evidence was put in place. He should have had to put an accounting of what happened in the shooting in the first day, since on his way to the hospital, he was obviously not injured, as the video showed when he was walking out of the police station.
Yeah. I can't speak to that. I mean, I don't know the details of exactly what he did and when he did them, you know, not being a scholar of those transcripts, and I'll take your word for it that's the case. But and that may well be the way that you know, in that police department, the way that they do things. I don't know, but you know, I think you're right.
He should have had to put a full accounting down of what had happened right then, so that it could have been weighed against the evidence later and not turned around and waiting till after the evidence so that he can have something that just seems like it's going to work.
Well, I thought that he was interrogated or questioned by a superior officer, which would be making a statement fairly quickly. You know, the guy, you know, his superior officer showed up very quickly and said, you know, what did you do? And he said, I had to shoot somebody. You know that.
Yeah, but there was no points of the issues that was ever brought forward until after all the evidence was collected. I mean, they said, yeah, we talked to him, but you don't know what he had said during that time.
Right, right.
And they've never made a claim, and they've never made that claim until such time as after an autopsy was done, and then his story just happens to fit perfectly.
Right, right. Well, that's, yeah. And, you know, again, we'll never know because there's not an adversarial process. Terry, thank you for the call. And this points out the need for that. We'll be right back. It's 20 minutes past eight. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Yesterday I was talking with Governor Jesse Ventura, and I had just seen, I'm holding it in my hand here, the drug screen for Darren Wilson, the police officer. And I noted that it says URN creatinine, C-R-E-A-T-I-N-I-N-E. And I've, you know, in my own urinalysis, you know, you get your annual physical, I've seen this word before, but I never knew what it meant. And it says that it was, you know, it's high, 331, the normal is 20 to 300. And so I asked, I mispronounced it as creatine rather than creatinine, I guess. And I asked Jesse Ventura, you know, what is this? What do you think? And he was like, well, I think that's one of the things the bodybuilders take, and maybe that would hype you up. Turns out, yeah, it is something the bodybuilders take, and no, it doesn't hype you up. But then a physician sent me an email saying the reason why on a drug test they look for this is so that they know that it's an actual urine sample as opposed to somebody just pouring water in a bottle. Because the kidneys produce creatinine as a consequence of the metabolism of creatine, I guess, which is an amino acid. I don't know. I'm in over my head here. But this just indicates normal kidney function. And the number being high on his part May mean that he was taking creatine supplements, or it may just mean that his urine was dark. I mean, you know, that he was dehydrated. And, but the reason why they do that is just to know that it's a real, you know, that he actually did pee in the jar. And so when everything else, cocaine, amphetamines, marijuana, opiates, phencyclidine came back negative, you know that it's a real drug test. So I was wrong about that, and I just wanted to clean that up. And my apologies to Governor Ventura for, you know, setting him up with something that was confusing. So all that said, let's pick up some phone calls. We'll do Anything Goes Wednesday here. Jeff in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Hey, Jeff, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I just wanted to call in. I think you made a really good point there about the process being really what's the issue here. And, you know, I work as a defense attorney, and I just would always hesitate to make a conclusion as a matter of law without having reviewed all of the evidence. In this particular case, it's problematic because there do appear to be a number of witnesses which basically forged their story for the publicity. And now, not that that doesn't discredit the overall narrative, but it just makes it extremely difficult without reviewing the totality of the evidence to really make a legal conclusion.
My point. And the prosecutor is asserting that there are witnesses who came forward who were local members of the community and who were making and presumably even people of color who were making assertions that comported with Officer Wilson's narrative rather than Michael Brown's friend's narrative. And, you know, but he's saying they're afraid to come forward, you know, for fear of being attacked by their community or whatever. So now we have, quote, anonymous witnesses. This is kind of Star Chamber stuff, you know.
Well, it really is. And it's kind of, I don't know, I think it's a miscarriage of justice ultimately.
Yeah.
But I think something that people don't understand is just really how low the bar is for a police officer, unfortunately. And it's, you know, a reasonable officer of like training and experience would have felt his life was in jeopardy under the circumstances.
Right.
And that's so distinct from a criminal defendant in a self-defense case.
In other words, it's much harder to prosecute a civilian for shooting somebody than it is to prosecute a police officer. It's much, or it's much, excuse me, the other way around. It's much harder to prosecute a police officer than it is to prosecute a civilian.
Exactly. If you're a civilian, you know, you have a duty to retreat if you can. There has to be proportionality of the force you use. Whereas for a police officer, all you really need to do is look at it and say, was he justified under the circumstances and feeling threatened? And that's right. Such a high bar to meet, unfortunately.
Right. Very interesting. Jeff, thank you for the call. Thanks for pointing. Before you go, any suggestions of an alternative process? Because that's where I'd like to go with this. I mean, the Michael Brown's family is calling for body cameras on police. I think that's a really important thing, and it's a great first step. But I think the second step we need to do is we need to reform our criminal justice system so that we can hold, you know, we can hold to account the people who, you know, we can answer the question, who will police the police?
You know, I really think there does need to be something. The only problem with the cameras, as you well know, in Albuquerque, we have a little bit of a police problem ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
They tend to somehow malfunction in a lot of the most, let's say, gray areas.
Yeah.
So although I like them, unfortunately, we still have a lot of cases where somehow a piece of it is missing. And they claim it was a mistake, but I guess you never really know.
Right. Yeah. And that's we've seen that with dash cams all over the country. You know, occasionally one will slip through where the obviously the police officer didn't realize that it was, you know, playing as they were beating the crap out of that person in front of them or whatever. But those are few and far between. I think they get sanitized very quickly. Jeff, thank you for the call. Pam in Seattle. Hey, Pam, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to I know people have called in and talked about The New Jim Crow by Michelle Alexander, and I don't know if you've had a chance to read that yet.
I have not.
But I think – I'm sorry?
I have not.
Oh, okay. I would highly recommend that book. You know, for me, it was just kind of the light bulb went off about our criminal justice system in all areas and is combined with racial discrimination. But basically, laws have been passed all the way up to the Supreme Court that immunizes the entire criminal justice system from claims of racial bias. Right. So in order for anything to change, we're going to have to get the laws changed. And I'm not sure how we go about that.
I don't either. You know, I'm not sure either, and but I'm going to keep putting the question out there because we do need to do something about this, and
yeah, you know, and it has to be by the law because you know the yeah. Supreme Court, you know,
yeah.
basically lets
yeah.
lets it happen, and nothing is going to change until we get that change.
Agreed. We have to figure out a way to deal with this. Pam, thank you very much for the call. And by the way, I you know one other possibility that I've recommended many times in the past is let's pay our police officers better. Let's require much more professional standards to become a police officer. I mean, Darren Wilson, you know, I was talking about how the metabolites in his urine seemed to indicate he might be a bodybuilder. Maybe this guy, and he said, I felt like a five-year-old. I felt like a kid hanging on to Hulk Hogan. Maybe this is a person who deep down inside is constantly frightened and thinks of himself as small and he's trying to bulk himself up. That kind of person should not become a police officer. So, you know, we need to have, assuming, you know, that there's a consistent thread, there's life there. We need to figure out what we're going to do with it. And, you know, how do we determine who gets to be a cop and who doesn't? Who gets to carry a gun and who doesn't? Who gets to take other people's lives or property with very little oversight and accountability, and who doesn't? Very little, at least, at law. I think we need to answer this. We need to answer these questions. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
And I think until we answer these questions, people living in minority communities, people living in poor communities, people who are typically the victims of police predation are not going to trust the system. Good, the bad, and the very, very incalescently ugly, the good. University of California students. On Monday, hundreds of students from across the University of California system walked out of their classes to protest planned tuition hikes. The proposed hike would raise tuition at California's colleges by 25% over the next 5 years, or 5% every year. Protesters released this statement explaining their action, quote, "Education is a universal human right. These tuition hikes, as well as concerted efforts by the UCs to privatize their schools, have attempted to transform education from a right into a privilege." Well said, students. Going to college in California actually used to be free before Ronald Reagan was governor. So let's hope Monday's action is just the start of a full-scale repudiation of the Reagan Revolution. The bad, Pat Robertson. During the Monday's episode of the 700 Club, the televangelist warned his viewers against fantasy-themed games like Dungeons & Dragons, saying they could lead to demonic possession. Check it out.
We did a long speech. There was a big thing about Dungeons & Dragons, and people actually got absorbed in this stuff. They took on those roles, and they began doing horrible things, and it was almost like an invitation to demonic possession.
Talk about living in a fantasy land. And the very, very ugly, Jack Whitley. Chair of the Big Stone County, Minnesota Republican Party is under fire this week for disparaging remarks he made about Muslims. This is the Republican chairman. In a post to Facebook Wednesday, Whitley said, "I'm opposed to waterboarding Muslim terrorists because it's a waste of resources. They are Muslims. They are terrorists. We know where they're from. We know where their buddies are. We know where their mosques are. We know millions of these parasites travel to Mecca every year and then frag them. Simplicity. I love it when it all comes together." End of quote. That, ladies and gentlemen, is the base of the Republican Party. And amazing. KP is posting over at democraticunderground.com, and I think it's a repost from Fire Dog Lake, from a blog over at my.firedoglake.com. The headline is "Transcripts Show Darren Wilson Lied to the Grand Jury." Darren Wilson testified that he, when he encountered Michael Brown and Dorian Johnson, that he knew that these were the guys who were suspects in the theft of cigarillos from a convenience store nearby. That was his testimony to the grand jury. He said, "It was not my call, but I heard the call." He said, "I looked in my mirror. I did a double check that Johnson was wearing a black shirt. These are the two from the stealing." This is what he said before the grand jury. Now, also, Sergeant LNU, his direct supervisor, who showed up on the scene immediately after the shooting, gave testimony to the grand jury. And here's what his boss said. Question: did he know about it? Did he know about the stealing? Answer: he did not know anything about the stealing call. Question: he told you he did not know anything about the stealing call? Answer: he did not know anything. He was out on another call in the apartment complex adjacent to Kenfield Green. And then a member of the grand jury asked a question of Wilson's supervisor. He said, "Now, my question to you is this. Are you saying that because he told you he didn't know about it, are you saying that because he told you he didn't know about it, or are you saying that because he didn't mention it to you when you were talking with him?" Answer: he didn't mention it to me Again, I learned about it at the later time. Question, has he ever told you, yeah, I didn't know anything about what happened up at the Ferguson Market? Answer, yes, he told me that in subsequent conversations. Question, he told you that he didn't know that there had been a stealing at the Ferguson Market? Answer, correct. Okay, so Darren Wilson told his boss that he didn't realize that this guy was a suspect in something between shoplifting and burglary. And his boss testified to that under oath before the grand jury. But Darren Wilson testified to the grand jury that he did know. Really? You know, thus providing him with a reason for the initial confrontation with Michael Brown. It's just, this is why there needs to be a trial. So that these conflicting pieces of evidence, in this case, the conflict between what Darren Wilson said and what his boss said he said, and in the other case, the conflicts in different witnesses that the prosecutor has, you know, put before the grand jury, that these conflicts can be resolved. That's why you have trials. Jesse in Madison, Wisconsin. Hey, Jesse, what's up?
So my wife is a sociology teacher, and one of the most surprising things that she gets to her students in her cultural diversity class is she brings up the nature of asking them who, as far as racially, is the poorest amongst our nation. And almost every time they answer, you know, some sort of minority, while it's actually white people is what it is. And the whole thing with this Ferguson situation, along with the nature...
Well, hang on just a second, Jesse. You're talking about not who is poorest, but which race has the largest population of poor people. And the reason why there's more poor white people than there are poor black people is because there's a lot more white people than there are black people. There's also a lot more rich white people. There's a lot more middle-class white people than there are black people.
Exactly. But what it really stems with, the whole first...
And the greatest poverty, by the way, if you're looking at deep poverty, I mean, like, bone... chilling, baby dying, malnutrition, rickets, teeth falling out, poverty. You find that on the Native American reservations.
Absolutely. Absolutely. But as far as the actual quantity of the actual, you know, the amount of people as far as population size, they still have a tendency to guess, you know, some sort of minority. Now, the whole thing with this Ferguson ties in with the nature of what you were saying about how the white racists get tied to the right wing, the black community gets tied to the left wing, and then you have the police officers. Well, what are the police officers? They're a union. So we have this theory between the two of us that the whole idea of what the media and corporate control is actually doing is literally creating factions amongst ourselves against each other, when in all actuality, we should be all standing with each other side by side, complaining about the things that are actually out there. We're creating a more militarized police force. We're basically arming them with soldiers that are actually coming back. We're super arming them with weapons. We're making them basically paranoid for anybody they run into on a day-to-day basis on the street.
Yeah.
You turn around, you have the exact same thing that's coming in from the white and black population towards the police officers, where you don't trust anybody. You don't trust each other. Is because we divided each other.
And then we've got media that does riot porn. Somebody also on Democratic Underground had pointed out earlier today that Andy of Mayberry never wore a gun. And he said the reason why is because when people are polite to him as a police officer, he wanted it because they respected him, not because they feared him.
Yeah, I mean, I actually think that to a certain extent that we're all entirely being manipulated into create little subcultures that really, in all actuality, we have the masses. We have the control. We have the majority of what's actually going on. But if they keep us divided amongst ourselves in on whatever line you want to pick one, you know, whatever the topic happens to be, there's a million of them that are out there.
Right.
Then we're all going to argue amongst ourselves.
And there are people who profit from that, by the way.
Absolutely.
If
the whole thing, it's all about profit and control.
If the billionaires can change the conversation from, are we being ripped off by the banksters? Are we being ripped off by the oil companies? Or, you know, are we being ripped off by Walmart? If they can change the conversation away from that and toward, look at what those black people are doing over there. Or look at what that white guy just did, or whatever, you know, to issues. A, that works to their benefit, and it works to the media's benefit. But I think that said, we also have to acknowledge that there are very real problems. I mean, there are
100%.
Racism, discrimination, institutional racism, a long history of this. you know, echoing down through generations and continuing to this very day. We have to acknowledge that is real, and that, and something needs to be done about that too. And I think that the Ferguson thing lays bare two really serious problems that we have. One is the racial disparities in the United States and the differences in how communities are policed and the whole, you know, all of those issues and just the whole issue of poverty in America. I mean, it's a very poor community that's being basically preyed on by a police department that makes millions of dollars every year giving people tickets for, you know, like walking in the street, for example, number one. And number two, that the police, when they kill people, are not as accountable as others among us are. And maybe because that's part of their job description, you know, that they may have to use deadly force. It's entirely appropriate that they be held to a different standard, but at least they should be held to some standard by some objective outside party rather than by an internal investigation with a prosecutor who works with them all the time. So that's what I'm saying. Jesse, thank you for the call. Jerry in Richmond, Virginia. Hey, Jerry.
Hey, good morning. I'm completely mystified. I'm just completely, utterly mystified. What's going on that we're taking a person who is a criminal? I'm at a loss for words. Let me ask you some questions.
You think it's entirely appropriate that somebody be shot to death for stealing cigarillos?
No, let me ask you some questions.
Do you think that police never inappropriately kill people?
I think they do. I think absolutely they do.
Okay, so what do we do about that, Jerry?
Okay, so here's the question. First of all, there's been all this talk about an unarmed man. Okay, can an unarmed man kill you?
That is not the question. The question is our system. I started this thing out, Jerry, by saying I'm not asserting guilt or innocence on either party. What I'm saying is that you'll never know, Jerry, and I'll never know, because there is no adversarial process. There is no opportunity to cross-examine Darren Wilson. You certainly can't cross-examine Michael Brown. He's dead. And in the absence of an adversarial process where conflicting witness testimony and conflicting evidence, including the witness testimony of the police officer who shot this man, whose testimony is in direct conflict with that of his supervisor, without a process where that stuff can be examined, we'll never know. And that's wrong.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Back to More or Less Anything Goes Wednesday. This seems to be the topic du jour right after this. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Cecilia in Kelseyville, California, watching Free Speech TV on DirecTV. Hey, Cecilia, what's up?
Well, good morning. And I do appreciate so much all the work that you and also Senator Bernie Sanders have been doing, as well as all of your people that work with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
I am aware that Ricky Jackson was just released, and thanks so much to the work of Brian Huff and the group of killing people with the Freedom Project. He's now free from prison, but of course not free from all the stolen years of his life.
Right.
But I was moved to call in because I want to share with you the horrendous corruption here in Lake County. We bought here some property in a place. We thought it was nice with a creek, so forth, so on. We have ruined the day that we bought here because of the corruption, and we can't sell out because we're involved with these people by accident. And the deputies are drunks. They cover each other when they're drunk driving. They don't ever write up anything. And the judges that know families can decree anything in favor of the families that they're friends with. They put spy cameras on their little girls in the bathroom and watch them.
Cecilia, I'm going to stop you there because I can't corroborate what you're saying. I don't know what you're talking about. And having individuals call into a show and start indicting a particular community's police department or whatever is just not appropriate. I'm sorry. It's if we want to have a conversation about the issues that are before us or about larger issues, fine. If you want to call up and complain about your local police department, start with your local elected officials. And if they're in the bag, call your member of Congress. Call your member of the House, U.S. House of Representatives. Call your senator. I mean, contact your governor's office. There are venues for that, but this show is not one of them. Brent in Roanoke, Virginia. Hey, Brent, what's up?
Hey, Tom. First, I think that guy who hypothesized about the divide to control made a brilliant point.
Yeah.
Second thing, I didn't really get Jerry's central point, would like to have, but here's my main thing. I think the issue is when policing, if you're afraid, it's legal to shoot.
Right.
And if you shoot, shoot to kill.
Right.
I think that's the central problem. And then I would very much reinforce what you said. I think progressives should stand, who people who stand for truth and justice should advocate to double the pay of cops, police, and expect professionalism and accountability.
Yep. And we need to have some sort of a system that is external to the police department and the local prosecutor to investigate problems with police departments.
Yeah, I personally know that the prosecutor once told me that his job was to keep his people happy. The charges that were brought, his job was to keep them happy.
Well, those are the people that make his job possible. I mean, if a prosecutor has an adversarial relationship with the police department and they will not testify or they screw up his cases, he's going to have a lousy conviction record. He's going to have a lousy career. I mean, his job is ruined. It makes perfect sense that, you know, just from a looking at it as a human being point of view, that people tend to want to protect the people that they hang out with, the people that they work with, the people literally on whom they rely to be able to do their job. And so we need to change that system because the system itself is broken. Brent, thank you for the call. Excellent point. We'll be right back. For the hour, Tom Hartman here with you, and Karen in Sacramento. Hey, Karen.
Hi. I wanted to take off on that caller that was a sociologist on that concept and talk about the solution for racism in San Francisco, as told by Ray Taliaferro, who was a 30-year radio host on the night shift and who had also watched Across the Bridge with Martin Luther King and Selma. And as the story starts, it's sort of like what you bring out in The Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight on how people are fearing that their cultures are going to be erased. And so when we're integrating society, Ray was saying people are afraid they're going to lose their cultural roots. So once they figured that out in San Francisco, they discovered it was the artisans and, you know, people who, the musicians who could work together. And so once they assured the general population that they could preserve their culture, the racism stopped to a large degree. And then they repeated this in Milwaukee, where I went to college in the 80s, and we started something called Summerfest. So you would have the Native American Indians would have Summerfest for 2 weeks, which is on the lakefront, and then you'd have the African Americans, and then everybody would get to preserve their culture. Right. And the reason why I bring this up is because there's been a lot of discussion from the community of the African Americans that there's been some talk about separatism again.
Mm-hmm. The point that I made in last hours, I'm assuming this is the one you're referencing, is that our culture, the white European dominator culture that has came to conquer North America and basically runs this country, has said to other cultures, whether they be Native American cultures or former slave cultures or Asian cultures, we're more than happy to have you join us as long as you become just like us. And that is the iron, that is the velvet glove over the iron fist of a dominator culture. And it doesn't acknowledge or respect other people's cultures or other people's roots or other people's histories. Excellent
right.
point.
And okay, thank you.
Okay, thank you, Karen. Excellent point. Well made. Father Joe in Omro, Wisconsin. Hey, Father Joe, what's up?
Yes, hi. I'm calling to represent two very powerful groups. One is the Association of United States Catholic Priests, and the other one is the Gamaliel organization. And we're both making both have published well-written, careful, strong statements on the racism. It's all about racism, and so we're taking a stand. The racist issue has to be addressed here. And so we're, with our occupation spirituality, getting out into the streets, saying something. My question to you is, in the face of this miscarriage of justice, do you think that what's happening in Ferguson is going to add fuels to the flame of racism, or will it be a counter thing to the...
Well, my experience...
Accomplish something here.
Yeah, my experience has been that it has allowed... That it has provided a space for the racists to come out. And... but it's also providing a space for people who want to live together to come out. And it's provided a space for a conversation about race and about policing and about, you know, class and all these various issues that all are pieces of this. Father Joe Matern, is it?
Matern. Joe Matern, yeah.
Matern, thank you. So you're actually speaking on behalf of the Catholics.
Yeah, the Association of United States Catholic Priests, which is a well-organized progressive Catholic
okay.
Priest group.
What is your call for action, sir?
Pardon?
What is your call for action?
Well, as I said, we call it, it comes under the heading of occupation spirituality. Get out in the streets. People have to speak up. We can't depend upon, Congress and so forth. We have to get out there. We have a responsibility to have discussions. We are conducting serious discussions on racism, and we are getting people out there to do the job.
Yeah. So if I could paraphrase, it sounds like what you're saying is that your call to action is wake up and wake up others.
Very definitely. And it's got to start at this grassroots, and we're committed to that as these two particular organizations that I have outlined here.
Right, right. Very good, very good. Thank you, sir, for the call and for your statement. Bob in Clifton, Tennessee. Hey, Bob, what's up?
Hello, Tom. I know that you're very interested in history and language, and I would like to propose that the evolution of our justice system has hinged on the change of language, or at least can be discovered there. In the beginning, we had a justice of the peace, and a peace officer was the court officer. And they were instructed to mediate any type of dispute in the public sphere.
Right.
As the country evolved, we became more urbanized, and we got judges and police officers instead of a justice of the peace and a peace officer. And the police officer, as you know from military service, is designated to keep an area safe. Nowadays, we have judges, and what do we call the court officers?
I don't know what they call them.
Law enforcement officers.
I see.
This is a top-down authoritarian attitude.
So everything is in place for the police state to kick into action?
Well, everyone becomes a suspect.
Yeah.
And therefore, we have selective enforcement of the laws.
This is what I, you know, Louise and I watched Citizen 4 over the weekend, the new movie about Ed Snowden. And that was my takeaway, is that the infrastructure for a police state has now been put into place. The button has not been pushed, or the trigger hasn't been pulled, or however you want to say it. But the infrastructure is there. And we could become like China tomorrow. And that's pretty scary. Bob, thank you for the call. And for the historical perspective. We'll be right back. Anything Goes Wednesday here, the day before Thanksgiving. They're reporting over 500 flights now have been canceled across the United States because of the storm coming up the northeast coast. It's snowing here in Washington, D.C. Well, it isn't now, but it was a little bit ago. So you might want to check if you're going to travel.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com, America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com, Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com, providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartmann.com.
This is the Tom Hartmann Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartmann here with you. It is the day before Thanksgiving, and a lot of people are going to be, a lot of people are traveling today. A lot of people are going to be getting together with family tomorrow. We hope to. the airline gods willing or whatever, the weather gods. But just an interesting little science factoid. And how this plays into how are you going to have a conversation with your family about the events of the day, the news of the day, particularly the Michael Brown shooting. And so these two things I want to share with you. Jessica Goldstein wrote a piece over on Think Progress on their blog yesterday, I think it was, at thinkprogress.org. It's titled, Why You Fight With Your Siblings Over Thanksgiving According to Science. And she's basing this on an interview that she had with a fellow by the name of Frank Soloway, who's an adjunct professor of psychology at UC Berkeley and wrote Born to Rebel, Birth Order, Family Dynamics, and Creative Lives. And also he published a research piece titled Why Siblings Are Like Darwin's Finches, Birth Order, Sibling Competition, and Adaptive Divergence Within the Family. And here's the net-net of what they're saying. When we are little kids, when we have siblings, when we have brothers or sisters, or brother or sister, when we're little kids, if you're the oldest, you are bigger, more physically competent, more intellectually competent, more emotionally competent than your younger siblings. And when you're 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12 years old, even a year or two makes a big difference in physical competence, emotional competence, intellectual competence. The oldest child typically takes on a role of pseudo-parent, basically. In fact, very, very frequently, parents will ask the oldest child to babysit, which is pseudo-parenting. Youngest children and younger children, on the other hand, are less physically competent and less emotionally mature and intellectually strong, and so they depend to a certain extent on their older siblings for their success and their survival in the family. And so while the older siblings, the older child, tends to be the one who runs things, basically, the one who's the pseudo parent, the younger child tends to be the pleaser, the one who tries to make everybody happy. Now, these are appropriate roles during childhood. They help us survive as kids. When we grow up and we go out into the world, we set aside those roles or we tamp them down. It's not appropriate to behave toward other people as you would behave as a 10-year-old to your 7-year-old younger brother or sister. Or it's not appropriate to behave with your coworkers or your partner as you would behave if you were the 7-year-old trying to interact with a 10-year-old. So we learn how to modulate, how to mediate those behaviors. But what happens is when we get back together for Thanksgiving or Christmas or Hanukkah or whatever it may be for holidays, we slip into those old roles because we don't see those siblings that often. And the majority of our life experience interacting with our siblings was in these roles of older child, younger child. And so we slip into these roles, and there's part of us that like just kind of falls into the role, and then there's another part of us that goes, "Holy crap! Why is he treating me like a little child?" And thus you end up with these sibling fights. So to prevent sibling fights at the holidays, just be aware of the fact that we all have a tendency to revert to type, to go back to the way that we behaved as children with our siblings, with the kids that we grew up with, and try to behave instead like an adult. And in fact, reinvent your relationships with your siblings as adult relationships. Number one. Number two, how then, if you're getting together with your family and part of your family are regular Fox News viewers, for example, how do you discuss Michael Brown with people like that? And, you know, if they're going off on, oh my God, it's black people going crazy. How do you respond to that? I mean, it's really easy to get angry or call people racist or whatever, but it doesn't work, especially in family. I mean, out in public, I'd have no problem with that. Slapping down some idiot or some fool in public or even in private. I mean, but family, you've got to maintain a relationship with family. Now, I don't object to labeling behavior like that, but it's not necessarily the most productive. I would suggest this larger frame that I've been talking about for 2 days here may be a safe way to have these kinds of conversations with family and not make things worse, not make things in your family worse. And that is to say, you know, it may be that Wilson was right or wrong. It may be that Michael Brown was right or wrong. It may be that this witness is right or wrong or that witness is right or wrong. But the fact of the matter is that we'll never really know, because the system that we have, in the system that we have, the person who watches the police, the local prosecutor, also depends on the police for his job. He depends on them for his ability to prosecute cases. He depends on him to get his conviction rate up so he's well-ranked or gets reelected. He depends on the police for his, literally for his job. And that working relationship very often also becomes a social relationship. And that's not the kind of environment out of which you're going to get objective information. You get objective information out of jury trials, with adversarial procedures, with prosecution and defense and both having the ability to cross-examine witnesses. And that did not happen in this case. And it does not happen in the majority of police-involved possible crimes by police officers. And I think we can all agree. I may be wrong on this, but I've had a couple of people call up and go, what are you talking about? You know, this kid was stealing. He's a criminal and a thug and blah, 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 you know, bully. And you know, my response to them is, you don't know that. And I don't know that, because there's been no adversarial process. There's been no confrontational legal process. And there needs to be. We need to figure out a way to have, we need to answer the question, who will watch the watchers? Who will police the police? And until we figured out a way to do that in this country, we're going to continue to have these kind of problems. That's one. And that's even setting aside the issues of race, which you can't really set aside. But if you don't want to argue it at that level, then you argue it at this 20,000 foot level. And you can probably find some level of agreement. And this is also the level at which we begin to solve the problem. So anyhow, just some thoughts for the holiday. Speaking as the oldest child, the oldest of four. So, of course, you know, my role was know-it-all. And, I'll take care of this. As the oldest kid in the family, that's I guess, oldest child, whatever. So as the oldest child, I am telling you, this is how you have to. Well, obviously you don't have to, but it's just some thoughts and some advice that I thought might be of value. I've shared many times the story of, you know, growing up with my dad, fighting with my dad constantly about politics throughout our lives. My dad has passed away now. And how much I valued that and how much I learned from that. That we learned ultimately to have political disagreements and not hit below the belt. Because when I was 16 and 17 years old, we both hit below. I'd say nasty things to him, and he threw me out of the house once when I was 16. And, you know, it was a very difficult time in our relationship. And thank God we got through it. And so I wish you the very best of the holiday season. No, I'm not wrapping up the show. I'm just wrapping up this rant. The very best of the holiday season. And hopefully what I said just then has some value to you. And if it doesn't, you know, I still feel like I've done my job as the older brother here. We'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Back to your calls and anything goes Wednesday, 15 minutes past the hour. And welcome back, 15 minutes past the hour. John in Roseville, Michigan. Hey, John, thanks for watching Free Speech TV on Dish Network. What's up?
Hey, I got a question maybe you could put up to Mike Papantonio next time you talk to him.
Sure.
Why couldn't the state of Missouri have used their attorney general to do this instead of that local prosecutor?
They could have. And that was a call that could have been made by the governor, and Governor Nixon chose not to do that.
Oh, maybe he's related to Richard. Yeah.
No, I think it was, Governor Nixon, consider the situation in Missouri. The governor is a Democrat. The lieutenant governor is a Republican. And I don't know who the attorney general is. I don't know what his party is. But at the highest levels of government in Missouri, the politics are very, very mixed up and scrambled. And so not being a Missourian, I don't know the details of the answer to this question, but for some reason, and I'm guessing it probably has something to do with that, some political reason, J. Nixon chose not to make this a state issue. He chose to just leave it as a local issue, and I suspect he's probably regretting that decision. When you look at how bad the publicity has gone for him and how badly this whole thing has gone, but that was a decision that he could have made to take it away from the local prosecutor. And it's certainly a decision that he could have made to do something parallel to the local prosecutor, because there's no jeopardy. There's no peril involved in a grand jury proceeding. So there wouldn't be an issue of double jeopardy. So he could have conducted a parallel investigation as well, which he did not do, although the Justice Department is doing that. So we'll see where that comes from. John, thank you for the call. Pat in the Dalles, Oregon. Hey, Pat, what's up? Thanks for watching Free Speech.
Yeah, and thank you, Tom, for what you do. Yeah, I was thinking it was rather strange. No one has brought up the fact that, that body laid out there in the sun, the August sun, for 4.5 hours. And I wonder whose idea that was to just leave the body laying there and, what message they were trying to send.
Yeah.
And also I would think, you know, from all these shootings and so forth all over the country, you know, of black people, you know, I would think that any police officer who fired 20, 30 shots into somebody ought to be fired. You know, there's something wrong with that.
Yeah. Well, this is 12 shots, but point taken. It seems to me that the carry-home message of leaving Michael Brown dead body on the street for 4 hours and you know, no ambulance, no nothing, just, you know, dead body on the street is we can do this to you. We, the white police officers of this town, can kill you and leave you to die in the street like a dog.
Yeah, and, like roadkill.
Yeah, yeah. And if that was not the intentional message, that certainly was the message that the community took. And being police officers in that community, they should have had enough experience, enough intelligence, enough common sense to know that if they do that, that's the message that people are going to take, even if that's not the message you intend. And, you know, I mean, it might have just been a cluster mess of some kind. You know, it's who knows? I mean, I don't know why that happened. But the message that the community got was, we can shoot you, we can kill you, and we can disrespect you. And that's a horrible, horrible message. Pat, thank you for the call. And I think the chief of police, you know, needs to be held to account for that. Although, again, I don't know a mechanism for doing that other than just publicity. We'll be right back. Past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Candace in Mansfield, Ohio. Hey, Candace, what's on your mind?
Hi. How are you doing today, Tom?
I am well, thank you. How about you?
Okay. Well, I kind of touched on the double jeopardy, and that's kind of what I was calling about, is everyone's talking about how acting like this is a done deal, and it doesn't have to be. The people of the community need to put pressure on their local and state government to still call in a special prosecutor, because it can still be done.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it can. And the state can initiate an investigation. I mean, there has been no trial, and therefore there has been no jeopardy, so there's no problem with double jeopardy. Double jeopardy is in the Constitution. It says you can't be tried twice for the same crime. So, you know, once they have one shot at you, that's it. And if you're acquitted, you're acquitted.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was thinking, is there's no double jeopardy in this case. They can still push it.
Right, because this is not an acquittal. This is merely a decision not to indict. And there's a world of difference. And I think the average American doesn't get that. The average American watching the news in little bits and pieces is assuming that a trial was held, that both sides were presented in a fair and impartial manner, that there was cross-examination of witnesses, and in fact, you know, none of that actually happened. And to the extent that the prosecutors claiming that both sides' cases were presented, you read the transcripts and you see that that's a very, very specious claim. Candace, thank you for the call. I think you're absolutely right. Rock, in driving through Washington State. Hey, Rock, what's up?
Hey, thanks for taking my call, and I appreciate you doing what you do.
Thank you.
I just wanted to say that, you know, we're all focusing on the wrong thing right here. You know, we got a kid that's not going to be going home. You know, we send Thanksgiving, we actually send our prayers, and you know, and that's what we should be, you know, doing, is just remembering that, you know. I mean, they are going through a tough time.
Yeah.
But with that being said, the only question I had is, I apologize if you have said it, but all I thought about was the urine sample that was taken on the cop, not about anything about Mike. And I'm just to be fair, you know, you should be able to say both sides. I have, but if you have said it, I apologize, but I haven't heard you talk about if he blood sample or anything. So
yeah, he did. I talked about it at 15 minutes past the last hour, because I'd brought it up with Jesse Ventura yesterday, and he did do a urine sample. There was creatinine, high levels of creatinine, which I thought meant that he was taking bodybuilder stuff or something. Turns out it just meant it was actually urine. He didn't provide them with water. And the creatinine is used to measure whether it's an actual urine sample. All the drugs he tested negative for: amphetamines, opiates, marijuana, PCP. There was one other. I forget what it was. And so that was the consequence of the drug test. Okay? Thanks a lot, Rock. Thanks for the call. David in Wellington, Florida. Hey, David, what's up?
Yes. Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking the call. I had a proposal I wanted to run by you, talking about the issue of a call to action.
Yeah.
I mean, first, I think it's important to have certain specific, circumscribed objectives. I think what's necessary for any political movement is to get surveillance, to get cameras on the cops, as people are talking about.
Yep.
To get a civilian oversight of police departments, including, you know, subpoena and investigative powers. And third, to have a permanent independent prosecuting function, an office, you know, modeled on the ones that have investigated the mob in the past, mafia infiltration in government and other forms of government corruption, that's totally separate from local prosecutors' offices.
Yep.
And the other, you know, the way I...
That's brilliant.
I haven't heard this... Well, I mean, this exists already.
Yeah.
This is not exactly a novel idea.
Yeah.
When local prosecutors are, you know, inherently biased by local connections, by undue influences of...
Or corrupted by the mob. I had totally forgot about all those mob prosecutions in the 60s and 70s, you know, that Bobby Kennedy initiated, and how that led to the, you know, basically a whole process that could be used. In fact, when Louise and I were dating, her father was the assistant attorney general for the state of Michigan, and he was prosecuting the Licavoli crime family. I mean, he was
right.
He had 24-hour state police, guarding his house, which made it much harder for Louise to sneak out at night. And we had to get around the cops. I mean, we were teenagers, right? And
I mean, the idea essentially goes back to, you know, Elliot Ness. That was the idea.
Yeah, yeah, bring in the feds because the locals are corrupt. Yeah, I got it.
Exactly.
A brilliant suggestion, David. Thank you very much for that. I appreciate the call. Colleen in Gig Harbor, Washington. Hey, Colleen, what's up?
Oh, I was calling about maybe the Justice Department stepping into Ferguson. I know that they were overseeing or watching what was going on, but does anything prevent them from stepping in?
Here's the problem.
No, there has to be a trial.
Right. Here's the problem. Under the Constitution, police powers are not conferred to the federal government. The extent of the police powers of the federal government has to do with federal crimes And murder is not a federal crime. Only murder of the president is a federal crime. And that's only been the case since after the Kennedy assassination. So it only applies to A, federal crimes, or B, to things that have to do with commerce. Because the Commerce Clause of the Constitution gives the federal government, explicitly gives the federal government the right to regulate commerce among and between the various states. So under the Commerce Clause, they have come up with things like they can regulate interstate travel, the federal government. The federal government can come in a state if a local trucker or a local pilot screws up, the feds can come in, right? But there's not an analog to that for policing, because the federal government doesn't have local police powers. So the only thing that they can do, there are federal laws, however, against discrimination against people based on their race and a few other things, you know, religion, national origin, ethnicity, and, you know, people are working on sexual orientation. But what they could do is they could do a civil rights investigation. They could say that Michael Brown was denied his civil right to life by virtue of his race. But they would have to prove that to a jury, beyond a reasonable doubt, that Darren Wilson intentionally took Michael Brown's life because he was black, not that that was a mitigating factor. And that's a very, very high bar. It's a very difficult one to do. And that's why I've been kind of groping around for some other model. And I'm wondering, you know, the last caller said, why not do it like the mob did? And like I said, my father-in-law was involved in those kind of prosecutions. But it just now occurred to me, I'll bet a lot of the mob prosecutions were done under the Commerce Clause. That was the authority that the federal government had, because the mob was involved in business. You know, the mafias had all the, you know, the money, from money laundering to Colleen, thank you for the call. Money laundering to prostitution, to drugs, to, I mean, you name it, right? So there may have been federal authority there that wouldn't be here. I don't know.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
All very interesting questions. We'll continue our conversation. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Steve in Fountain Valley, California. Hey, Steve, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Love your show.
Thank you.
Read several of your books, but not the latest one.
Okay. Your question or comment?
I wanted to say, I'm not as articulate as you are, but it seems to me we had this case here in Orange County a couple years ago with Kelly Thomas. And although, you know, he wasn't a person of color, you know, a homeless person beat to death on the street by the police and unarmed. But the district attorney in that case prosecuted the cops, and a jury, you know, let them go. So in this case, we have a jury, supposedly a grand jury, but you know, you can argue about whether the information they were given was correct or analyzed properly, but it seems to me that we as a society have accepted the fact that, well, the cops can kill us in the street.
And the other piece of that story, Steve, is that in the case that you described where the cops killed a white guy, they ended up in court. And in Michael Brown's case, where the cops killed a black guy, they did not end up in court. The grand jury is not an adversarial legal process. It's not a criminal trial.
I agree, my point is as a society, it seems to me that I don't know if this process is sudden or slow, but all of a sudden it seems like this is becoming more and more acceptable, like that guy in New York that was selling cigarettes.
Yep.
He happened to be a large guy, and they, you know, cases. You know.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I think that what's happening is that it has always been acceptable / unnoticed by the white majority in the United States when the largely white police kill or abuse black people. And if you go back to the riots in the 60s, they were almost all, I believe, always initiated by a person of color being killed by a police officer or being assaulted by police. And there have been attempts to push back on that, and those have produced some reforms. and some changes in policy and perception. And on the other hand, they've hardened some hearts, I suppose. And I think that what's happening now is that America is going through white America is going through, and I think both white America and black America, and I hate using those definitions because they imply a divide, but there really is one. So, you know, you have to acknowledge that, are both going through a bit of a reboot where average white folks in America are starting to say, now many aren't, you know, the Fox News watchers aren't, but many average white folks in America are going, wait a minute, you know, this is what goes down. This isn't right. This is not acceptable. And you're seeing a lot of white faces in a lot of these protests all around the country. And on the other hand, in the black community, they're saying, you know, we're just not going to take this anymore. And we have been, you know, raising hell for a long time and trying to make, you know, everybody aware of this. But now we're just not going to stop. People have to know what's going on, and we have to do something about what's going on. So I think, you know, you make a good point, Steve. Thanks for the call. David in Des Moines, Iowa. Hey, David, what's up?
All right, Tom. Long-time listener.
Thank you.
First-time caller. Mm-hmm. My thing, I wanted to talk about the racism part of this, which I feel is always intertwined with the police in the country. And it's always been hard for me to explain to, like, my white friends and family members, you know, how it feels to be black in America. But now that President Obama has been president, I just go back to that, and I have to use that as an example to say, just look at how everything for him is harder, how they won't work with him, how it's harder for him to get legislation passed, how the obstruction, like the unprecedented, the filibusters and all these things like that. Right. That, to me, is exactly how it feels to be black in this country. You know, you can, you know, he has great qualifications. He's totally qualified, but when you go to try, you know, everyday life, this is, you know, you kind of run into these walls like this, and you can't just say, oh, it's racism, because then, you know, you're accused of, you know, being a racist yourself.
Yeah.
And one of the things I like to point out about racism is that it's always talked about from the black perspective, like, you know, like how black people were treated and in the past and things like that and up till today. But the thing that gets overlooked, it's like the damage that racism has done to whites in America, because to me, it's really given a lot of white people like a false sense of superiority. It's kind of like when you're on that top of the hill, you want to protect it. And you see that like with the police and with the attitudes as far as like a jury where they will constantly find a police officer, you know, not guilty, or that's even if it gets to trial. Because they see the black person as being kind of like inhuman in a sense,
or less than fully human, or less than equal. I agree, and I think that that's destructive to society as a whole. And you know, whites are the majority of society right now. It's destructive to white people as well. I absolutely, and the sense of entitlement that comes with it, and that's why I was constantly going off in the last 6 months or so about white privilege, that white people don't understand white privilege. And when you got somebody who's got a profile like Bill O'Reilly denying that such a thing even exists, you've got a serious problem in the white culture in America that Bill O'Reilly represents, which is his generation's my generation's white culture. And that's a serious, serious problem. David, thank you for the call. Very thoughtful analysis. Denise in Chicago. Hey, Denise, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I've talked to you before. Thank you so much. I waited to form an opinion as I watched the prosecutor, and I've been listening to some of the, you know, the news experts that have gone through the testimonies to before I reach to my opinion as a U.S. citizen. Mm-hmm. My final opinion is kind of sad, and it's kind of cynical, and it's really a result of actually what the caller you just talked to about the taking down of Obama. I believe that this was a far-right orchestration and an opportunity that was used. That prosecutor set the stage for violence, knowing that there was anger and that it was brewing. Otherwise, it would have been, well, let me make the other point, too. At 8:30 at night, in the dark of night, could you see white people starting any of these fires? Could you see white people instigating these things? That's cynical, but
to the sea, the reaches of what this Republican openly has said about Obama. You know, it's really a lynching. So they set the plate. The prosecutors set the plate. They have now let and put it in the lap of Obama. Sure, Holder is the prosecuting attorney for the federal government, but it's really on Obama. So my recommendation to President Obama.
Wait a minute, Denise. How is this on Obama? Murder is not a federal crime.
He's black though, and this is about black and white. And it's a spin of what's he going to say and what Holder is going to do.
Well, Obama is walking a very narrow line with this. I get that. In fact, you know, his statement a couple of days ago, maybe it was yesterday, where he said, it's not my job as president to be speaking about an individual case. That's up to the state. But the Brown case is meta to a larger issue of race in our society and policing and community policing in our society. I thought he was spot on those comments. And he was doing a good job of stepping to one side of the issue of race.
I totally agree. But when
at least of his own race.
When has the right ever said anything good about anything that Obama has done for the good? So I guess my only point is, if I was the prosecuting attorney for the Holder as a black man, I would just take the playbook from the far right and use everything I could to investigate thoroughly this situation, along with the others that are going on.
Oh, I believe they are. The problem is that they're
very
narrowly circumscribed by federal law. They can't look into whether there should be a prosecution for murder. They can only look into whether there should be a prosecution for murder as the result of race. And that's a very high bar.
The card we play? Yeah, but if that's the card we have to play, then play it.
Oh, yeah, they're doing that. They're absolutely doing that, and you count on it. And there's an enormous amount of pressure on Eric Holder to do something about this, and I believe he is. Denise, thank you for the call. Tom in North Hollywood, California. Hey, Tom, what's up?
Hey, Tom. First off, I want to say that I think what needs to happen is, again, we have to start at the beginning. And the beginning is having community policing, having police actually making friends with people in the community, being part of the community.
Yep, who live in the community, who look like the community, who interact with the community, who walk the beat rather than drive the car. Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, I think that is one thing that definitely needs to happen. And again, it's like anything else in this country, infrastructure, whatever it is, we got to start with a foundation of something. We can't be jumping in the middle of the game and trying to, you know, to redo the whole thing. We have to, you know, right from the get-go, we have to make sure that we start when these kids are smaller and younger, and, you know, we can take care of these problems before they become, you know, such a huge problem. My other thing that I have, this may be my ignorance as a white man, is, you know, I grew up in a town of 2,000 people in Wisconsin, and I know there's a lot of not educated people maybe in terms
Tom, we're running out of time. Hold on just a second. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
15 minutes past the hour, before the hour. More of your calls right after this. So, Tom, finish your thought.
Okay, so basically, like I said, growing up in a small town of 2,000 is that the only education that people really get about maybe black people, gay people, whatever it might be, is from TV.
Yeah.
And the problem that I see is that whenever they're depicting or they show, you know, a black person, they show it in either an angry, harsh, stereotypical, you know, someone, you know, playing the rap music up to, you know, 100 decibels and, you know, all of this stuff that brings out fear.
Well, those are the stereotypes that you'll see on Fox News over and over and over again. But I think increasingly in mainstream media, we're seeing black people portrayed as just ordinary people like white people.
And the only place, Tom, if I really can say this, the only place where I've ever seen where black people, I think, are treated in the way that I've actually seen the black culture is actually on the soap operas. If you look at the soap operas, They never, you know what I mean? It keeps it in an equality fashion rather than having one race above another.
Right.
And it's really interesting. If you get a chance, just,
I have not watched a soap opera since I was 8 years old.
I just find it very,
haven't been home during the day, but yeah.
I find it very interesting because, you know, the Cosby's was one, and I remember years ago my mom even saying, almost like she couldn't believe that black people were lawyers.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And I wasn't blaming her. It was just that was the world that she kind of grew up in.
Right.
And I just think that, you know, as we have more portrayals of black characters and black people in media also, that we can start to take away some of the fear that exists.
Yeah. Tom, you're the publisher of the Gay and Lesbian Yellow Pages in North Hollywood.
Yeah.
And I'm curious if your thoughts on correlating this to, for example, Stonewall riots.
Well, I think exactly, one, of course, is that the gay community, especially when it came to AIDS activism and the different groups, ACT UP and, you know, all of that, they also protested. They did protest, I believe, in a more nonviolent way, just used their voices, very strongly. Also, I think the gay community, is more invisible to the masses. So the thing is, you know, we don't have either being our skin color or having being like a female,
right,
to actually show that we're different.
Right.
So we blend in more with the community at large.
Right.
And because of that,
on the other hand, you know, the miscegenation laws have been set aside for 20 years or more, and it's still illegal for gay people to get married in more than half the states, if my recollection is correct.
Oh, absolutely. No,
so,
we got to keep on fighting for marriage equality around the country and getting those equal rights. It just seems that I even think the right wing really took a page out of the 80s when the gay community fought back against Reagan.
Yeah. Yeah.
And what they did.
I think you're right. Tom, thank you for the call. Good to talk. It's always good to talk. 10 minutes before the hour, we'll be back with Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service. Let's check in with Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service. Talk Radio News brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com, where you can give a goat to help a returning slave in South Sudan, and free-don.org. Ellen, welcome.
Well, thank you so much. It's interesting, Tom. Health insurance, this is Secretary Sylvia Burwell. She said that during the first week of the open enrollment period for healthcare.gov, there were 462,000 people enrolled. One half of those did not previously have health insurance. So this time it is working, but of course you don't hear much about that.
Oh, that's interesting. So we're not hearing about the open enrollment period because everything is moving smoothly. Maybe they should screw it up for a day or so that they can, jumpstart the news cycle.
Exactly. When things roll smoothly, you don't hear about it.
Right.
It's interesting. I was in New York City last night on the 63rd floor of a building right in front of City Hall. You could hear people shouting. The protests were so loud, saying, hands up, don't shoot, Black Lives Matter. And then when the Manhattan Bridge was blocked by the police, said, whose bridge? Our bridge. They closed Lincoln Tunnel for a period of time, FDR Drive. And as you know, this went on in many other cities. And this is clearly, you want to talk about that match at Ferguson. Well, there's really a lot of pent-up anger and about not only community policing and how it's done and who they go after, prison sentences, all of that is coming out. And I do remember when President Obama was elected, he said, you cannot do race relations on the cheap. You have got to really make some meaningful changes.
Yeah, I agree.
Okay. Ruth Bader Ginsburg, she's 81 years old, Supreme Court Justice, was nominated under Clinton in 1993. She had a stent in her right coronary artery. She was apparently exercising quite a bit, works out with a trainer at the Supreme Court. You know, they call, there's actually a basketball court on the top of the Supreme Court, and it's called the highest court in the land.
I had no idea.
That is really a true story.
Yeah.
Okay. A couple other things. You know, we talked about them not saying much about health insurance, et cetera, but yesterday they dropped a couple of interesting regulations. One, which made the front page of the newspapers, one did not. One is related to new teacher preparation evaluation system. And what they want to do is have specific metrics to the states that states would come out with. It's called value-added modeling. And the American Statistical Association calls it the test and punishment model, punishment to teachers who don't necessarily meet the statistical whatever they have to be, but they're not really taking into account where students are from and where they start out. There is a 60-day comment period, and I encourage people to do that, even though it was sort of brought in under the Thanksgiving. Well, nobody's going to pay attention to this, so regulations are going to go through. Hopefully, they won't.
Yeah. Okay.
Also, and this did make the front page today. Yesterday, the EPA came out with an ozone standards. Now, it may not seem like a lot to us, but apparently it's a lot. And right now they want to lower the threshold from 75 parts per billion to 65 to 70 parts. But now it is, I think it's billion, not million. The standard is they want it to be 60 parts less.
The
environment.
So they want to tighten up the standards.
Like. That's right.
Yeah.
But again, who knows what's going to happen with that. Although the president is pardoning the turkey and that's going on today, there is a tax deal, and this is my last story, and there's not a lot of stories today going on. There is a tax deal that David Camp agreed with, and he's a Republican from the House, and he agreed with Harry Reid on some issues. Now, interestingly enough, it's a tax extender bill. The White House says that they are probably going to veto it. They say that it does not help working families. It produces deductions for research and development that a lot of these companies do not necessarily need. The question is whether it's $400 or $450 billion, depending on what you're reading and who you're paying attention to. It's somewhere between that. And, of course, you never know with a tax bill because you never know exactly what people's taxes are going
right to
be. It does allow for a tax deduction for college tuition, but there's a lot of people that say that it's not doing what it should do, and David Camp is probably going to be on the bad side of the tax reform folks and Grover Norquist because to some people it is increasing a tax. However, again, the president is threatening a veto on that.
Yeah. So from the Republican point of view, they're like, how dare he collaborate with Harry Reid? And then from the Democratic point of view, including the president's, they're saying to Harry Reid, how dare you agree to extend tax breaks to billionaires and oil companies and transnational corporations when you're not extending any kind of tax relief or any other kind of relief. In fact, the earned income tax credit is going to go away, you know, which is a principal source of support for a lot of very poor people, working poor people.
Dr. Tom, you are always able to say things very succinctly.
Thank you. It's what I do for a living, I guess.
You do it. I do it for a living, too, but you do it a lot better. I'm sorry I don't have a lot more news for you today.
Well, that's okay. We still have a minute. I'm just curious what you're hearing from these protests all around the country where people are saying enough already. And if anybody has offered any clear suggestion, I keep asking the question, who's going to watch the watchers? Who's going to police the police? Obviously, you can't depend on a district attorney to investigate the local police department because his job depends on that local police department.
Well, and also, I mean, everybody sees each other at the same small restaurants and same small areas, and so
exactly
there is this.
So how do how do we do this systemically?
I've got to tell you, I just actually did a piece on this recently, Tom, because there is a racial component. Let's just call it for what it is.
Yeah.
But there's also other components. There was a police shooting in New York City in an apartment building where they shot a guy dead. They shot him in the chest. He was just simply walking down a dimly lit stairs in
right.
Cleveland, Ohio, my hometown. A young 12-year-old was playing with a BB gun in a playground.
Right.
And apparently the police asked him to put his hands up, and maybe he didn't hear it, and they shot the kid dead.
Yeah.
So something is going on in the way they're training these people. You know, why aren't they, if they really want to promote peace and all that and not shooting people?
I think you're right, Ellen. Thank you.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, and I'm glad to have you. And we're going to take a break for about 20 minutes here from the conversation that we've been having for the last couple of hours and go back to the Tom Hartman University mode. Dan Sisson is with us, the author of The American Revolution of 1800. He's a distinguished professor of American history and the revolution coming our way at the Tom Hartman University. On the banks of the Potomac, he's an adjunct faculty member at Eastern Washington University, where he teaches the history of technology in the engineering department. And many thanks to them for bringing him to us by Skype. Dan, welcome.
Thank you, Tom. Good to see you.
No, thank you. We're up to chapter four now in our analysis of your book, The American Revolution of 1800. And first of all, I'm curious if you see any parallels or concordance or contrast, for that matter, between the revolutionary era and the revolutionary spirit of the 1770s and or of 1800, and the I think it's revolutionary, the as in, you know, overthrowing the established order behavior that we're seeing all across the United States now in support of Michael Brown and of support of changing our policing methods or the way that we police the police and confronting the issues of institutional racism in the United States.
Well, I don't think there's any question that when you have a situation where people in authority are viewed with suspicion, when the institutions of society no longer function the way that they are supposed to according to the principles of our system. You have discrimination. You have disenfranchisement, you know, huge unemployment, all the rest that is striking also the middle class in addition to the minorities, that you're going to have disaffection and you're going to have desperation. And I think that that's what we're beginning to see after, say, 30 years of policies which have led to this. And if you go back to the 1770s, these are the very conditions that produced the attitude that made revolution possible.
Yeah, the Boston Massacre.
The Boston
Massacre. I mean, you know.
Absolutely.
As I recall, at the Boston Massacre, only one guy was killed, right?
No, I think there's like seven or eight.
Oh, there were?
So,
oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay, well, who was...
Nevertheless.
Yeah, who... Go ahead.
Go ahead. I was just going to say that what we should view here is that local rebellions can sort of publicize the issues And what that does, it expands. It's like dropping a bottle of ink into a barrel of clean water. You know, this whole thing just diffuses throughout the society.
Right.
And there is a point in which you can't turn back, in which the establishment has lost all of its credibility. I mean, all you have to do is just look at the economic scene since 2008 to 2007 and realize that none of these bankers have – not one has gone to jail, and the whole justice system is now being called into question. People everywhere are doing this.
Yeah, so we're living in a revolutionary time. Now, in Chapter 4 of your book, The American Revolution of 1800, you are talking about the American versus the French Revolution's theory of revolution, as it were.
Right. The reason I do that is because I feel that the contrast, especially in terms of expectations, revolution always involves expectations of freedom or liberty or a better life or whatever. And what we see is that the influence by the Americans on Europe at this time was simply an incredible expectation. And so when one of the leading countries of France goes into revolution – about the rights of man, echoing our Declaration of Independence, all of a sudden you have people talking for the first time in their lives, maybe ever in the history of Europe, about how every man should have certain rights guaranteed, and it's your duty as well as your right to demand those rights. And this upends everything about the nature of European society. So this is something that Americans just assume as a birthright, and yet we see in our own time all these things, like when Bush instituted torture. There is nothing that I can think of that contradicts the principles of America than being the country that initiates torture the world over. We won't close Guantanamo Bay.
Right. It's a huge betrayal of our own principles.
Absolutely. And we can't get Americans to think about things like this and their revolutionary heritage unless we begin to think in terms of principles. Just looking at whether the president says something or whether the Senate says something is insufficient. We have to get down to something that's more basic and that involves us all.
Yeah.
And I think that principles is the way to do it.
Yeah. How did the principles contradict the form in the French Revolution and lead to disaster? The French Revolution ultimately you could say it was successful, but over the short term it led right to Maximilien Robespierre and the terrors and the guillotine and all this, you know, which is not the outcome that certainly Thomas Paine was expecting when he went over there and got thrown in jail.
He got thrown in jail. They tried to come for him two or three times to put him in a guillotine.
Yeah.
And this is part of the problem. And this gets back to the first part of our book when we talk about faction and party. And when you start looking at what happened in France, first of all, if you could say compare it to America, we had the states. And the states were independent, sovereign entities when they came into the Articles of Confederation. People were attached to their regions and their localities, and they were used to electing local officials. When you go to France, by comparison, the provinces existed, and some of the representatives to the parliament were from the provinces. But the first thing that Robespierre did was to use the force of party and faction to destroy the what you might call the welling up of equality in those provinces through their representatives. And he sort of dismissed those people. And all of a sudden you had all power concentrated in the hands of Robespierre and his faction. And then they start talking about we have to have everything one and indivisible. Well, this is death to a revolution because it means that the people who are out there in the countryside, in the provinces, or in our case, the states, are just simply cut out from any authority. I mean, does that sound familiar?
Yeah.
Isn't there fear about the federal government being able to go to war whenever it wants to, not consulting our representatives, not consulting the states, the fear of money pervading our system so that it shortcuts all of these people that we elect in good faith, but they're bought off? I mean, this has now become so recognizable that it's like an acid that is undermining the basic principles of America, and we've got to reverse this if America's going to survive.
Yeah, and I think the people in the streets right now are saying that. Yeah,
yeah, I think so. In their own way, yeah.
Yeah. Jefferson's final thoughts on the cause of the failure of the revolution in France?
Well, I think that those final thoughts are that Jefferson saw what can happen if you allow faction and party to become paramount in any political movement. You know, Jefferson's one who said, if you're going to attain liberty, it has to be by degrees. It's going to be slow but sure, and that we can't get everything all at once. You can't concentrate everything in one small group of people. And after Occupy movement in New York last year, one of the things I'm hearing from some of the people that were involved is we've got to have a party that can concentrate power. And they're using, you know, examples of permanent revolutionaries like Lenin and others. This is not the American tradition of revolution. If you look at America, you're talking about basically a conservative nation. And it's
well,
not
conservative,
gonna go up.
Conservative, not in the way that Fox News would characterize it.
Oh, absolutely.
We're very much a liberal nation in that context. But you mean in terms of just slow incremental change over hundreds
That's
of years.
That's right. Institutions. Yep.
Yeah, of institutions. Dan Sisson, his book, The American Revolution of 1800. You can find it in your favorite bookstore. It is just recently out. Co-author Tom Hartman. We'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
The American Revolution of 1800 by Dan Sisson, S-I-S-S-O-N. And welcome back, Dan. You're still with us?
Sure am.
Okay, great. I'd like to squeeze another 5 minutes out of this this conversation if I can. But I've gone through the questions that we talked about. Where for chapter four, what would you say is the main arc of chapter four, and how is it relevant to today without being redundant or too redundant?
Well, I think the main ideas of chapter four is that we have to make a connection between form and principle in our society. And if we don't think both in terms of form and principle, then we are likely to lose our institutions or the ideas that make them viable and protect things like our rights. And
so can I make a modern day comparison? The form that the grand jury did in Missouri with regard to the Michael Brown shooting, the form was a legal process that should produce truth, right? But the process actually wasn't. The process was badly corrupted by the prosecutor's relationship with the police department, which is an entirely natural thing. I mean, his job depends on the police department. And so because of the principle of you know, examining crimes regardless of who committed them,
right,
the form that we use to execute that principle failed. Am I making sense here? Is that what you're talking about?
Well, let me just phrase it in a slightly different way. The grand jury investigation is something that even Jefferson was proud of that America had within its legal system. But the grand jury investigation is supposed to be operated by a prosecutor, and they're always looking, you know, for the evidence of guilt. And what we see here is the reverse of this principle, in that the prosecuting attorney who was in charge of the investigation acted more like a defense attorney.
Right.
And so here we are. The guy's not indicted. The evidence is conflicting that's been put out. There are different all kinds of witnesses. We don't know if anybody's even been cross-examined. I mean, there's all kinds of what you might call suspensions of the normal protections that citizens should receive under the system. And that the principle is that we are guaranteed these things. We have the right of to originate legislation. Nobody can take that away from us. And so basically all across America, when you have these situations, we're seeing the establishment protecting itself.
Right.
And when we think about protesters, I think the protesters should be given equal protection whenever the military or the police or anybody else are called in. And what we have is a sense that that principle is not maintained, that we're protecting property, We're protecting the buildings or the businesses. That's what's emphasized.
Right.
And we've got to get back to a point where we start, you know, claiming our rights.
Right. And that's what's being shown in the news with all this riot porn that we're seeing, rather than pictures of a dead kid on the street, which really should be the topic.
That's right.
Yeah.
I agree.
Yeah. Remarkable stuff. Absolutely remarkable stuff. Dan Sisson, you've written a brilliant book, The American Revolution of 1800. And I commend it to everybody. It's a great holiday gift. And, Dan, thanks for being with us today.
You're sure welcome, Tom.
And please give our very best to everybody at the university there to help make it possible.
Yeah.
Thanks. We'll be back. Funny minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you live. As we're speaking, the president is pardoning a turkey. I like the mayor of Seattle. Mayor of Seattle pardoned a topher, right? That's the way to do it, right? A tofu turkey. I mean, it's not a turkey. Yeah, it's a vegetarian turkey, of course. Gerald in Simi Valley, California. Hey, Gerald, what's up?
Great. Thank you for taking my call. I have 3 points, if it's possible, to discuss them. The first one is, if you comply with what the police officer asks you to do, you don't get shot.
Really? Tell that to the guy who was walking down the stairs in an apartment building in New York City day before yesterday.
You have isolated incidents, and if you're going to say because of an isolated
incident. Tell that to the guy who was selling cigarettes on the street.
Every police officer is bad. Then you have to say.
I'm not saying that, Gerald.
Muslims that are blowing up people, all Muslims are bad, and that's what you're doing.
No, I'm not saying that, and you're making a false equivalence. Your premise is faulty. There are many people who comply with police officers and end up getting the crap beaten out of them. Gerald, you're going to try and talk over me. It's not going to work. Eduardo in Columbus, Georgia. Hey, Eduardo, what's up?
How you doing, Tom?
Good.
The last caller just completely missed your point. I understand what you're coming about for that. It's mainly the lookout for who's looking out for the police, basically. That's the main issue.
Who is policing the police? Who will police the police? We have to answer that question in our society because we have failed to answer that question in our society, at least with regard to minority populations, for 200 years.
Exactly. The other point I want to bring, Tom, that I don't know if it's possible or not, can the citizens of Ferguson say the prosecutor really, you know, did not do his job? Can that prosecutor be recalled?
He could be if the voters of the city got together. Actually, he's for the county, so it'd take the county voters. I think what's more important at this point is for a special prosecutor to be appointed because there was no jeopardy in the original grand jury. In other words, there was no risk in that grand jury hearing that Darren Wilson would be prosecuted or sent to jail. This was a hearing before a trial, and so because there was no what's in legal terms called jeopardy. There was no possibility that he could go to jail regardless of the outcome of those hearings. They can be repeated by anyone, anytime. He has not experienced jeopardy, so he cannot claim a defense of double jeopardy. Now, the Constitution says you can't be prosecuted twice for the same crime. This was not a prosecutorial process. So a special prosecutor could be appointed. The attorney general for the state of Missouri could look into this. There may be other venues in Missouri that I'm not familiar with where there could be an investigation. It's still possible to prosecute Darren Wilson. The question is, does anybody in Missouri have the political will or power to do so?
Yeah, but they need to look into that. And people still need to realize that the federal government can only do certain things. Like you mentioned, stop looking at the federal government for this situation.
Yeah.
We have to look at the state level and the local level, like you've been saying.
Yeah, totally. And, I mean, there is a role for the federal government in things like civil rights violations where the local governments are completely corrupted. But it's we need to figure out in this country, right across this country, every town in America, we need to figure out who's going to police the police, and we have not figured that out well. Eduardo, thank you for the call. Well said. Linda in Alameda, New Mexico. Hey, Linda, what's up?
Well, I just wanted to say that I feel that the Ferguson situation is a symptom of a much larger problem in our country, and that being that the oligarchs, which are largely wealthy white men and corporations, are getting a lot of benefit out of all the divisiveness that is happening. It happened with Trayvon. It's happening with the attacks on women in politics and, you know, ad infinitum.
Right.
And
they're trying to, I mean, right now they're trying to slip through a tax reform bill that'll give more tax breaks to billionaires and big corporations. I mean, as we speak.
Exactly. And while we're all looking at what's going on in Ferguson, and while we're all getting divided against each other in terms of race or ethnicity or sexual orientation, all of that.
Right. Yeah, well, thank God the president said that if they cut this deal, he's going to veto it. I'm so impressed by that. You know, it's that's you know, the president standing up. It's a really, really, really good to see. Linda, thank you for the call. CJ in Bluffton, South Carolina. Hey, CJ, what's up?
Hey, Tom, how's it going?
Good. What's on your mind?
Hey, listen, I hate to break it to you, but Title 18, Section 1111, homicide actually is a federal crime. Under the special jurisdiction as outlined in Title 18, Section 7.
Right, which identifies the circumstances of the homicide. For example, killing a federal officer, killing a president. These were laws that were put on the books after the assassination of Jack Kennedy, were they not?
Well, actually, the law was first, it was enacted June 25th, 1948, so it does predate that.
Oh, okay.
And it also includes any murder committed on federal property.
Right. But the street in Ferguson was not federal property.
Right. But you've been making a blanket statement that homicide is not a federal crime.
Okay.
That's not totally true.
Okay. You're absolutely right, CJ. Thank you for correcting me. I appreciate it. Mark in Sarasota, Florida. Hey, Mark, what's up?
Yeah. Hey, Tom. How are you? I wanted to bring up the fact that, you know, the eyes around or witnesses tell the whole story. And I think that one of the remedies for these police-citizen confrontations is have these cops be wearing body cameras and dash cams all the time. And if they turn them off, they're immediately terminated.
I don't know about the last part of that, but that is the essential call to action from Michael Brown's parents. They are calling for every cop in America to wear a body camera, and I totally support that. And I think you're adding, and by the way, if you turn that camera off, you lose your job, is like a really good idea. Or because we had a caller, or maybe it was Mark Taylor Canfield, a reporter earlier. In fact, I think it was yesterday, we were talking about the body cameras, and he said that in that town, there were numerous cases of alleged police misconduct, and they were wearing body cameras. But on those days that the police were accused of misconduct, somehow the body cameras were malfunctioning, failed. They forgot to turn it on, whatever. So we have to, I mean, you know, no system is perfect. We have to figure out a way around it. But thank you, Mark, for the call. Number one, yes, I agree with Michael Brown's parents. Every cop in America should wear a body camera. Number two, we need to answer the question, who's going to police the police in this country?
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
And policing the police includes prosecuting the police when necessary. We'll be back. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And 28 minutes before the hour, Ryan in Eureka, California, listening on KGOE. Hey, Brian, what's up?
Hey, Tom. First of all, I'd like to wish you and yours and your staff a happy upcoming Turkey Day.
Thank you.
But if I may, I'd like to diverge a little bit from the hot topic of the day, as I think you've received a lot of thoughtful calls on the issue. Instead, I'd like to share with you a slice of history, as I know both you and I enjoy and use history to dialogue and debate with our fellow citizens. And you may already know about, you know, this story, being the expert historian you are, but let me just share with you that I subscribe to a publication that reprints stories of the Old West. And, of course, I'm not going to read you verbatim, but let me give you the Reader's Digest version of a story that comes out of Benton, Montana, Dateline, October 10th, 1988, River Press, Fort Benton, Montana, and it starts with a quote, "If Montana wants early admission as a state, her representative should be a Republican. Montana can make no mistake in any possible event in choosing a Republican delegate," and unquote. This was from the Helena Herald. And the people of Montana had heard that kind of talk for many years, and after the strings had been harped upon for several years, the people of the territory finally took Republicans at their word and elected a Republican delegate to Congress. This was 1871. There was then a Republican president, a Republican Senate, and a Republican House of Representatives at the national capital. All the conditions were favorable for a Republican delegate to accomplish favorable legislation for the territory.
Right.
And what did they get? Did they get a United States Mint? No. Were appropriations made for the improvement of the Missouri River? No. Was Montana admitted as a state? No. Did the people get a single thing they wanted, asked for, and expected? Not one. What did the Republican delegate to Congress do for the people of Montana? Nothing. Absolutely nothing. But for himself and a few others, he got an appropriation of $1 million for a mythical tribe of Indians. And it's taken 14 years of hard work upon the part of the Democratic delegates to Congress to undo the mischief did by a Republican delegate in one short term.
Wow. Wow. Amazing.
How about that?
Yeah. Fascinating facts. Brian, thanks for calling and sharing that. That is interesting. Ryan in Sugarland, Texas. Hey, Ryan, what's on your mind?
Hi, Tom. Have a happy Thanksgiving, by the way.
Thank you. And the same to you, sir.
I'm an ex-libertarian, as well as a friend of Huey Newsom, who you often have on.
Great. Huey's a great guy. Yeah.
Indeed he is. You asked a question a little while back saying, who will police the police? And although I think body cameras are definitely a great idea and should be universally done throughout the nation, I think ultimately civilian councils, which would be a panel of 5 to 8 people, it's kind of arbitrary, appointed by the community to decide who is hired or fired as far as the police goes. I think we need the community to decide who is policing. Because if you don't have the community trusting who they have out there, I mean, you can't have order. You can't have a just order.
Well, and Ryan, what you're suggesting has precedent in the history of our country and the structure of our country. When the founders of this country were contemplating there being a military in the United States, which would be the federal equivalent of a police force, an armed force, they wanted to make sure that that armed force, that military, did not have the ability to regulate itself, that it would be under the supervision of a civilian who was answerable to we the people. And so they made the president of the United States, an elected civilian, the commander-in-chief of all military forces in the United States. So similarly, at the local level, if we were to say our police forces must always be under civilian, presumably maybe even elected, community control rather than under basically their own control, rather than, you know, being autonomous agencies, that would, you know, be analogous to the president being in charge of the military. What do you think? Ryan?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, that could ultimately cure problems like, you know, Rodney King in the early 90s and even issues like Ferguson, because ultimately the people would be able to throw the person out in case that the court didn't act appropriately in the matter.
Yeah, yeah, I agree. Ryan, excellent suggestion. Thank you very much for adding to the dialogue. Kurt in Los Angeles. Hey, Kurt, what's up?
Hey, Tom, I'm nursing a call, so I'll be as brief as possible.
Okay.
But happy Thanksgiving first off.
Thank you. Back at you.
And you asked a question a couple segments or actually hours ago. How will people, when they gather for Thanksgiving, talk about this without old feelings coming up about hierarchies in the family and prejudices and, you know, arguments coming up?
Right.
And I wanted to suggest a good starter talking point would be to pop in a movie called Rosewood, which is a true-to-life movie that was made in 1997 starring John Voight and Ving Rhames, the guy who co-starred with in the Mission Impossible movies. It's a story about a town that lived in harmony, all-black town after the Civil War, lived in harmony with a white town until one bigot decided to start a lie, and it resulted in the good whites having to decide, choose sides between the whites and the blacks, end up in a massacre. And it'll just show you how easy it is for one rotten apple in a society to taint the whole thing. So we can talk about getting along and moving forward all we want, but as long as we let racism persist in our country it'll never, ever get resolved. And just like you just had a caller that called up just moments ago saying, if you obey the cops, you shouldn't be getting shot. That's not true, because there are people who are coaching Aryan Brotherhood people to get into law enforcement specifically for the reason of having a license to kill black people. There's literally a movement right now, which leads me to my second point. Tom Metzger, people in key positions. You need to research that guy. He's dangerous. He's coaching Aryan Brotherhood people to get into law enforcement, get into judges, attorneys, into government.
Who is this guy?
Tom Metzger, Metzger. He's a former Grand Dragon of the Ku Klux Klan. He's ran for political office multiple times, beginning in 1978, unsuccessfully. But he tried last time in 2010 along with the Tea Party crew. He doesn't get through because people know who he is. He's like another David Duke.
Yeah.
Okay? He's a level of a David Duke.
Yeah.
But because he's so well known, he doesn't get through. But you got to understand, every time some of these Tea Party people open their mouth, they've always had something racial to say, the dog whistle.
Oh, yeah.
And people say, you know, the people we write them off as being radical. But yet they're getting into office, and they're the crux of what's going on with the gridlock.
Yeah,
in Congress right now.
Yeah, they're the point of the spear of the hard right, of the hard right. I'll have to look up Tom. Thank you for the tip on that, for the suggestion, Kurt. Appreciate it, and thank you for the call. Have a great Thanksgiving. Ann in Sugar Grove, North Carolina. Hey, Ann, what's up?
Hi, thank you for taking my call. Mm-hmm. Also, just to add to the biggest caller, police training videos. They depict black and brown as bad and evil and demon-like.
Really?
I've seen a couple of documentaries on it. Yeah, just actually stop Googling and go to DuckDuckGo. That's the one that doesn't keep track of what you research.
Yeah, I had the founder, DuckDuckGo, on the show about a year ago. I've reset all of my browsers to use DuckDuckGo.com as their
right.
default web browser.
Yeah.
But
my real quick point, I watched the interview of Darren Wilson, and he was asked a question, you know, about how many officers were in the police vehicle, and he's, because George Stephanopoulos, I guess, assumed two, and he said, oh, no, one. We always have one. And I'm like, wow, how long have two-person police cars been around? Ferguson's using one. I feel like it's just another example of their system setting up to deliberately fail the citizens of Ferguson.
Yeah.
The other point I want to make is he said he had time. He changed out a clip. He put another clip in his gun in that interview. Watch it. I watched
that. I was wondering how he got 12 bullets out of a, you know.
It made me sick to sit there and watch it, but I made myself do it. And my very last point is I heard this morning in a conversation on The View where he participates, the officer participates in a hockey league. Now, how violent is hockey?
Yeah, but that, just because somebody plays hockey doesn't mean that they're a stone-cold killer or even an impulsive, wimpy, self-image of a little child killer.
Right, but it just sort of adds to the pile.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not, and that's what this is. It's a whole bunch of things. I mean, I worked in a prosecutor's office, in one of the U.S. attorney's offices, and never, when they were investigating defendants, was a defendant ever brought in to the grand jury room to be questioned.
Right.
Never.
Well, typically the defendant doesn't even know that the grand jury has been impaneled to look into him.
Right, exactly. And this prosecutor, oh, my gosh, he's so biased. I mean, his father was shot and killed. I mean, he should have been taken off that. They should have had a special prosecutor from the get-go.
Yeah.
I'm just – and down here, oh, the gunshots are going off because everybody's so happy. You know, the Confederate flag is flying in North Carolina on a regular daily basis. And the N-word is used all the time down here in western North Carolina and probably the whole state. But
yeah.
I'm experiencing it here where I live in
Well, I heard it
so,
two nights ago from a group of white folks, about the Darren Wilson, Michael Brown thing, and was pretty startled.
Yeah, my neighbor actually said she wanted to kill Obama, and she used it like strangling him, motioned her hands that way, and I said, "You want to kill him?" She goes, "No." I'm like, "Well, strangulation is killing."
Yeah. It's an ugly time. And thank you for the call. As an ugly time, I think that, you know, it's like childbirth is a messy process. You know, transitions are difficult. But let's make this a transition. Let's make a better society out of this situation.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
You know, like Ronald Reagan used to say, there's got to be a pony in here. Hopefully we can have positive change come through. Welcome back. 15 minutes before the hour. And Matthew, watching Free Speech TV in Dayton, Ohio. Hey, Matthew, what's on your mind?
Oh, I'm Matthew, fine.
You're on the air.
No, no, I'm waiting to agree with, Tom Hartman.
No, you're on the air, Matthew.
No, that I'm on hold.
No, you're not on hold. You're on the air right now. It's just you won't hear it on your television for a minute or so because there's a time delay. So just talk to me on the phone.
Hey, Tom.
Hey, turn your TV down, Matthew. In fact, Matt, you there? Okay. Matthew, I'm going to put you on hold and so you can figure this out. Matthew's on line 9, and Danielle is going to tell you what's going on. Jesse in Miami, Florida. Hey, Jesse, what's up?
Hey, hi, Tom. Happy holiday to all.
Well, thank you.
Thank you very much for talking about a bad revolution. It seemed like some forces want us to go that way.
Yeah.
Okay, how can we avoid it? Hey, getting cameras on all the cops, I bet all the cops would wish to say, don't give me a camera, give me more pay. But the main thing is, have Ralph Nader, Al Sharpton, Bill McKibben, or whatever the guy that runs the, all these progressive leaders, have they ever heard of Thomas Paine?
I'm guessing most of them have.
Yeah, they have, but they ain't doing nothing about it. All the problems they represent are babies of economics.
Yeah.
If they knew about Thomas Paine when he said, we don't need a king of England to rule ourselves,
right,
they could just update that. We don't need these economic royalty to rule us.
Yeah, as FDR said.
Together, we could put the Couch brothers, whatever, out of business overnight. Overnight, but they.
Yeah, your point is.
Amazon, all the cops.
Your point is well taken, and in his Thomas Paine, you know, in Common Sense or in The Crisis, his first publication, he actually coined the phrase "the United States of America." He's the guy who named our country. Thomas Jefferson said that without Paine's initial pamphlet, there never would have been a revolution, and I think that that's true. And Paine then wrote a book called Agrarian Justice that most people don't even know he wrote, and in that book, he calls for every person at birth to be given basically a pension so that by the time they become 21, they have a basic minimum income for their entire lives. He called for Social Security. He called for unemployment insurance. He called for a minimum wage. He called for basically all the things that it took 150 years for, you know, until Franklin Roosevelt put most of them into place. And you're absolutely right. Thomas Paine was not just one of the fathers of this country, but one of the genuine revolutionaries. And one of the guys who was not a slaveholder. He was very into the rights of man.
Tom, I said again, we could have a living wage for the whole world if we use some common sense and have the bravery or courageousness to do it. So everybody have a good one and take no more of your time.
Thank okay, you. Jesse, thanks a lot for the call. Great to hear from you, and I wish you a very, very happy Thanksgiving. Matthew, I'm going to pick you up in just a second. I've just got 10 seconds here until I'm going to hit a break. So I've got the point is, if you want to know about Thomas Paine, the best book that's ever been written is by Harvey Kay, and it's called Thomas Paine and the Promise of America. It's a brilliant history book about the founding era of this country and one of our most overlooked and largely ignored founders. In fact, Thomas Paine was largely ignored because he wrote The Rights of Man, which is a screed against religion. And that's everybody turned their back on him when he did that, when he came out as an atheist, basically. And it took Thomas Edison to bring him back into the American dialogue. He was absent from all of our history books until Thomas Edison came on the scene. Hey, thanks so much to our show director, Louise Hartman, to my executive producer, Sean Taylor, to our associate producers, Shane Farnan and Danielle Gilday, to our video director, Jim Javinsky, to our writer-researchers, Andrew Campbell and Nate Sweet, to Alva Goldberg for video production, to our webmasters, Nigel Peacock and Jamie Holly, to our business manager, Ron Hartenbaum, to all the companies that and groups that syndicate our program, Westwood One, Pacifica Radio, SiriusXM Satellite Radio, Cable Radio Network, Free Speech TV on Dish Network, DirecTV, all the cable providers that carry our show, Manhattan Neighborhood Network, all the great folks at Free Speech TV and RTTV who work on The Big Picture, to the Progressive Voices channel on TuneIn, to Netroots Radio, to our newsletter editor, Sue Nethercutt, and the folks in our chat room. Hey, To Ellen Ratner, Victoria Jones, Bob Ney, and everyone at the Talk Radio News Service. To Jay Goodman Tamboli for tech support. To our affiliates, our sponsors, our underwriters, and to you for supporting our program. Thank you so much. So, back to the phones. Matthew in Dayton, Ohio. Hey, Matthew, what's on your mind?
I was calling about, you know, like for the verdict, you know, that happened in Ferguson.
Right.
I was wondering if it was true, you know, like that one attorney, Mike Capitonio or something, said it wasn't over.
Right. It doesn't have to be over. The grand jury investigation was not a legal process that represented a threat to Darren Wilson's freedom, and therefore it didn't have what is called at law jeopardy associated with it. There was no danger to him in that process, an immediate danger to him in that process. And as a consequence of that, you can revisit that process. You can go back and do it again. There could be another grand jury. There could be a special prosecutor. There's a whole bunch of different legal forms that could be used to re-examine Darren Wilson. That said, it's extremely unlikely that anybody in St. Louis County or in the state of Missouri is going to do that. I don't think anybody there has the political will to do it. But, you know, I could be surprised. So, make sense, Matthew?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Thank you very much.
Sure enough. Thanks a lot for the call. Bob in Sherman Oaks, California. Hey, Bob, what's up?
Hi. Tom, I'd like to talk about something that maybe you've covered in all the times that you discussed the killing. The Attorney General Robert McCullough.
He was the prosecuting attorney for the county.
Yeah, the prosecutor. His most famous or infamous case was called the Jack in the Box case.
Right.
That happened in 2000. It's covered by Newsweek as well as Wikipedia, but I looked it up to make sure it was in Newsweek. The Jack in the Box case, and I'll read, two undercover officers, police, drug enforcement, they killed two unarmed black men in the parking lot.
Right, and the officers fired 21 shots, and they killed the suspects, Earl Murray and Ronald Beasley, and then McCullough did not prosecute these officers. You're right.
Well, the grand jury didn't indict. What he did do is give a press conference similar to this, saying that all the witnesses claimed that the car was moving towards them.
Right.
The St. Louis Dispatch did an investigation on this and found out that in the testimony, only 3 of 13 officers said that the car was moving forward.
Right.
Okay, that covers that. He should have recused himself.
Right, and he also had the comment about Murray and Beasley. He said these guys were bums. Right? I mean, you know, he's...
Yes.
I mean, it's just...
But it's also...
Go ahead.
I know, because you're going to give me very little time, if I could just try to...
Go for
this,
it.
And then any comments you'd like to make. Okay, great. He also has... His father was killed in the line of duty.
Right, in 1964.
By a black person.
Yep.
Everybody in his family, his mother, brother, uncle, and cousin all worked for the St. Louis Dispatch Department. And then he has his father as a person who was murdered.
Right.
He has had a history of public profile cases, including Axl Rose.
Yep.
And he's been in this position since 1991, but he has been not telling the truth in many of the situations, especially as you just talked about the case in which they did not indict. He stood before the press and lied about what the people testified
to. Yeah, which I believe he did the night before last as well. The St. Louis Post-Dispatch did a really good article that summarizes everything that you're saying right now, Bob. And you could track it down by plugging into your search engine. St. Louis prosecutor has faced controversy for decades, and St. Louis Post-Dispatch. It's on the stltoday.com website. And it's,
how could they not? Haven't more people been asking and pleading and demanding, especially the federal, that he recuse himself given his history from this case.
Yeah.
And two, I would think that the Civil Rights Division would have plenty of our government has stepped into many situations before, and the historical background of the lies and his personal history and his wrongful lies about the Burger King case should be enough to have taken this case away from him.
I agree. And this is what Jay Nixon should have done as the governor. And he did not, and he failed to do. And now Bob McCullough has done the exact same thing at least twice that we know of, and in similar circumstances. And the federal prosecutors, the Department of Justice, can only go after him. Eric Holder can only go after Darren Wilson or the police department for killing a person because he was black, for depriving a person of the civil right of life as a consequence of his race. And to do that, they have to establish a pattern of such behavior. And I think that what you were just laying out is an argument for there existing already, right on the record, a pattern of such behavior in the St. Louis County District Attorney's Office. Make sense?
Can I mention one other thing that's unfortunate for our country?
If you can do it in 5 seconds, we're out of time.
Okay, it's the Ferris Doctrine. Nobody can ever be sued in the government during warfare, or soldiers can't sue. Nobody.
Oh, you're talking sovereign immunity. Yeah. Yeah. Then I understand that. But I'm out of time. I can't talk about it. From all of us here at the Tom Hartman Program to you, we hope you have a wonderful Thanksgiving holiday. Be sure to tune in for some of our great best of episodes. And don't forget, democracy is not a spectator sport. Get out, get active, and occupy something. Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, visit TomHartman.com.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman Program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com. Total protection. Quicken Loans. Engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com. Your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.